Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
And this episode of Groundwire is produced on Haudenosaunee Anishinaabe Traditional Trading Territory in Kingston, Ontario, by CFRC. We are your hosts, Douglas Farquhar
and Tash Carroll. In this episode...
Thanks so much for coming out here to support the Halifax Typographical Union, the striking workers of the Chronicle Herald.
So what the City of Montreal did on Monday with their symbolic motion is not a sanctuary city.
Colonialism, settler colonialism, the act of colonization was directed at very specific things, but they couldn't take down those everyday acts.
But first, here are the headlines.
Our first headline comes from Douglas Farquhar at CFRC in Kingston, Ontario. Have a Heart Day, February 14th, 2017, was a continuation of a project that was set up a few years ago. And this one, Have a Heart Day, is a child and youth-led reconciliation event that brings together caring Canadians to help ensure First Nations children have the services they need to grow up safely at home, to get a good education, to be healthy, and be proud of who they are. If you'd like to explore more, go to Have a Heart Day website at fncaringsociety.com/haveaheart. And some of the examples you get from it are bring reconciliation into the classroom. And by doing so, teachers could maybe do a project related to the blanket exercise workshop or screen a film. And other ideas you can find by visiting Shannon's Dream school resource pages. Also, another project idea would be spread the word through social media. So whatever social media you're using, but you could use the hashtag Have a Heart Day, or you could use Journée ayez un cœur.
Our next headline comes from Ome Salma Rahemtula in Toronto, where Food Service Works at the University of Toronto Satellite Campus in Scarborough are on a rolling strike.
What do we need?
Thursday, February 23rd, striking food workers from the University of Toronto's Satellite Campus in Scarborough held a rally to end poverty wage jobs on campus. Food service workers at the Scarborough campus, as well as at York University, are employees of Aramark, the food service subcontractor that holds a monopoly over food services on university campuses across the country. Aramark employees at the Toronto universities are on a rolling strike, demanding better wages and benefits. This strike is part of a larger movement for the Fight for 15 across North America, demanding a raise in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Currently, most food service workers at the Scarborough campus are paid only $11.50 an hour. This year, the main downtown campus of the University of Toronto decided to internalize food services and end their contract with Aramark, resulting in significant pay raises for food service workers. Scarborough campus workers are asking for an equitable treatment from the university. Dasan Jesudarsan has been a cook at the Scarborough campus for 10 years.
We are working very hardly, but we're getting only for the living wage. This is not enough for our family, right? I have three children. It's not enough my family. That's why we are striking this right now. Scarborough worker there, Scarborough UFD, the food service worker, just only working for the $11.50, same job, downtown George campus, you'll work in over $18.
Another issue that striking workers are concerned about is the increasing workloads due to an increasing student population at the satellite campus, while at the same time seeing a reduction in the Aramark workforce, resulting in more work for remaining workers.
One dishwasher working 23 years, he getting only for $11.50. Before he have... we have three dishwasher. Now it's only one dishwasher. He working all the job. Now this more the student it was more there.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Wait, don't turn the page. The island hasn't taken proper notice yet, babe. Avoid dead eyes. Don't watch this lazy wind reform the next step. snuff it out.
Just heard Radio Radio by Megan Hamilton.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
On Monday, February 21st, the city of Montreal voted to become a sanctuary city. Measures still need to be taken to ensure that undocumented persons in the city can live their lives without the constant fear of deportation. CKUT's Mary Krabby attended a press conference organized by Solidarity Across Borders that proceeded to the vote and interviewed migrant justice activist Jaggi Singh.
Yesterday, we were at a conference at Concordia organized by the organization Solidarity Across Borders after the announcement of a new motion that would declare Montreal a sanctuary city. To talk about that, we met Jaggi, member of the organization, and several other people that believe that we can and need to do more for migrants in our city and in our country. Let's go.
I'm a mother for two children. My husband deported last year. And since that, my children are suffering a lot. I want to live with my children, with my husband, in safe and peace.
Hello, I'm a non-status woman living here in Canada. Got sick, no access to Medicare, got sicker and sicker from diabetes, end up losing my eyesight because of that.
Toutes les demandes d'avoir un statut légal au Canada, résidence permanente, permis d'études, permis de travail, m'ont été rejetées, malgré avoir fourni tous les documents requis.
Now, to understand fully the concept of a sanctuary city that appeared in the U.S. for the first time in 1979, with Los Angeles being the first, let's listen to Jaggi's explanation, a member of Solidarity Across Borders, about it.
A sanctuary city, if we're going to understand what it is, we should just understand the word sanctuary. When you tell somebody you're giving them sanctuary, whether you're a city, whether you're a synagogue, a church, a mosque, whether you're a person, when you're telling somebody you're giving them sanctuary, you're telling them that you're giving them safety and security and protection. So a sanctuary city means a city that gives safety, security, and protection to migrants, refugees, and undocumented people. So what the city of Montreal did yesterday, or on Monday, with their symbolic motion, is not a sanctuary city. Because on a very basic level, protection for non-status people, for undocumented people, would mean that when they have an interaction with the police, whether that's a casual interaction, whether that's an accidental interaction, whether that's the police deliberately starting an interaction, okay, whatever the reason, if you were to have an interaction, you would not face removal or deportation. And that is not something that is dealt with by the current motion that was passed by the city. So we cannot say that Montreal is a sanctuary city.
Okay, what do you think this motion would change actually for people living without a legal status in Montreal?
Well, I instead of using the term legal status, I just prefer to use the term undocumented. Your immigration status is simply an administrative category and really doesn't have nothing to do with you being legal or illegal. But what the motion does is it's symbolic. It does say that undocumented people can now have access to municipal services. So one thing to be clear is that, you know, I've been doing support work with migrants for more than a decade, and the priority for migrants is not, they don't come and seek the support of groups like Solidarity Across Borders asking for access to library cards and being able to enroll in exercise classes. Rather, they are seeking health care, they are seeking education for their kids, they're seeking housing that is safe and secure and affordable. Mm-hmm. And they're seeking work. All the four things I just mentioned are extremely difficult when you are undocumented. Moreover, they'd like to be able to go about their lives in their neighborhoods and in the city without the fear of being deported because mm-hmm. they have some sort of intervention by the police accidentally or deliberately. So those are the main things. So the Sanctuary City motion by the city doesn't address those main things. The city doesn't have the authority to deal directly with education or healthcare, but it does with the police. But one symbolic minor change is that undocumented people are supposed to not be asked for their status if they're accessing city services. But again, like I said, that was never a priority. Moreover, there's no information within the motion and no funding, because it's purely a motion. There's nothing sort of that backs it up to indicate that there would be a public awareness campaign, that city workers would be trained properly in dealing with these things. We as Solidarity Across Borders will be doing what we always do. We do direct support with migrants. We're fighting deportations. We're receiving calls every day for people who are in some situation of precarity vis-a-vis the immigration system. And we'll continue to put pressure on all levels of government for substantive, real change. Mm-hmm. And that isn't symbolic, empty declarations. That is the City of Montreal saying that there would cease to be collaboration between the police and the Canadian Border Service Agency. Mm-hmm. That would mean that on the Quebec level, on the provincial level, that there would be guaranteed access to education for kids who mm-hmm. currently don't have free education, access to free education, as well as being able to get a RAMQ card, a health card, regardless of one's status. And on the provincial, on the federal level, most importantly, that there be a ongoing, comprehensive, and inclusive regularization program, so the upwards of 500,000 or more undocumented people living in Canada, with tens of thousands living here in Montreal, can have status. And moreover, that the Canadian government should open the border so that migrants and refugees can get in, especially now that we have the context of the various presidential decrees by Donald Trump.
Our next feature takes us to the streets of Halifax, Nova Scotia, where striking Chronicle Herald workers commemorated the one-year anniversary of their strike on January the 23rd. The Chronicle Herald is Canada's oldest independently owned newspaper. Last year, workers walked off the job in opposition to deep concessions in their contract negotiations. At the time of the one-year anniversary last month, talks had resumed, but since, contract talks have broken off. Franchella Fiolis from CKDU in Halifax brings us the following soundscape of the one-year anniversary of the strike.
Sisters, brothers, comrades, and friends, thanks so much for coming out here to support the Halifax Typographical Union, the striking workers of the Chronicle Herald. It's been one full year, 365 days in all manner of weather, that these folks have been on the picket line. They were forced on the picket lines January 23rd of last year in a defensive strike against a union-busting employer.
Shame! Shame!
My name is Leanne Heller. I'm an editor on strike from the Chronicle Herald. Looking back on it, I don't know really how we got to this point. I don't know why more people haven't fallen ill. It's very, very stressful to be on a picket line and to not think of your life as anything but being on strike. That gets to you after a while.
A year on strike for this nonsense. There's absolutely no reason for this strike. It's crazy. We've offered them to get out of their pension plan. We've given them wage cuts. We've given them concessions across the board on areas, and it's still not good enough. What kind of employer, any other employer, would take what we've offered and be running with a big smile on their face? We finally got these guys back to the table. We have to beg, borrow, and steal to get these guys to come to the table. But we've got them there, and we're hopeful that we can make a breakthrough. But I'll tell you one thing. If we don't, this fight is going to get louder, stronger, and harder. And we're going to come at them with more guns in the next month, in the next 2 months, and the next year if necessary.
The union bargaining team and the management bargaining team are meeting. They're going to be meeting this afternoon. They've been meeting all last week, and that is a precedent in itself because it's been a long, long time since they've sat down at the table together to talk. So we're, you know, the expression, cautiously optimistic.
This, at the end of the day, is about quality jobs and quality journalism in this province. Do you want it?
Yes!
And if we want it, we've got to fight for it.
It's Paul Schneider-Wright, editorial writer and columnist. Been with the paper 33 years.
Well, the paper itself, I think, is a shadow of what it was. You have very inexperienced writers. There's a lot of mistakes in the paper. Some of the judgments being made are quite questionable in terms of stories. So it hasn't been very good, and the public has noticed.
Have you had a look at the newspaper? Do you remember that lovely story about the Syrian refugee children? Well, that's just one example of the kinds of irresponsible journalism that is being practiced by the Chronicle Herald. Press releases used as entire news stories. Sources plucked from the pages of Facebook instead of actually going out and interviewing people.
Friends, there are some anniversaries that you celebrate, and there are other anniversaries that you just mark. And there are a number of things that we mark today on this Black Anniversary Monday. We mark first, as Tony has rightly said, the abject moral failure of the McNeil Liberals to respond with the effectiveness and engagement and responsibility to this labor relations disaster that has been being called for from them now for 365 long days.
Shame!
I'm Lisa Roberts. I'm the MLA for Halifax Needham, representing the NDP. We've tried to support the Local Express, both by being available for interviews, and a number of MLAs are advertising on the Local Express, which is the publication put out by the striking workers. And then just raising it in the House of Assembly when we are in session, and asking the provincial government to show some leadership, because this is a particularly important institution. I mean, journalism is plays a role in democracy. And
we're fighting for our rights now. We shall not be moved. We're fighting for our rights now.
Our final feature comes from Douglas Farquhar at CFRC in Kingston, Ontario, and focuses on Aboriginal writing and literacy with Queen's University Aboriginal scholar Geraldine King in conversation with Professor Sam McKechnie at CFRC.
Geraldine Indigenous, Keashkazaging Anishinaabeg Ndonjaba. My name is Geraldine King, and I come from Keashkazaging Anishinaabeg near Thunder Bay, Ontario, and I'm a first-year PhD student in cultural studies here at Queen's.
My first question for you today relates to the fact that you are both a literary artist and someone who studies literature. And so how do you sort of navigate the relationship between those?
Well, that's a really good question, Miigwech. I consider myself more of a fledgling literary artist, so I have a lot of people to look up to, and of course, Eden Robinson being one, Leanne Simpson, Lee Miracle, all these really awesome Indigenous women who have paved the way for this sort of arts to emerge. But storytelling has obviously always been a part of our intelligences, but I think it's really powerful to have something to lean back on to inspire myself. Sam, you know, you've mentioned to me before to embody writing styles that I enjoy reading, and I'm so pleased to be able to have an abundance of examples to draw back on. Of course, I'd say particularly Leanne Simpson. So, you know, and I often wonder how it was for them, maybe not having the same access that I have to Indigenous women writers. But I guess with navigating, it is, there's a lot of support from community and people. But I'm also trying to incorporate my theoretical foundations and my academic intelligence and PhD work into creative writing, which poses challenges, but at the same time it's very liberating and an act of resurgence, I feel, to bring those sorts of conversations into my work and have it supported here.
How do you use the idea of the erotic in your work? How does your work kind of grapple with what erotics means, and what are some of the, I guess, cautions or concerns that arrive when you think about the erotics?
Well, the one thing I think about the erotics is that it's not new in Anishinaabeg intelligences. Like, I could look at a lot of our stories and pull out themes or mannerisms or parts of our language or thought or the cosmos of all this knowledge we have that are, in fact, erotic. That may not be identified as such, but the two major things I fall back on are storytelling and our humor. like I've always grown up with just these incredibly humorous stories, mm-hmm. but the punchline often relates back to something erotic, like mm-hmm. lips will point or laughter will happen at certain cues that have to do with, you know, love and romance and attraction and desire. And there's all of these sort of instances. And it wasn't until I did start looking at it more in a theoretical lens that I was like, oh, wow, we've had these stories for forever. And it's really just emphasizing that that aspect of love and caring, but also sexualities and desire and sex are a part of, are not alienated from our own way of interacting with one another and relating to one another. And I was just talking to my supervisor last night. We were talking about how, you know, colonialism, settler colonialism, the act of colonization was directed at very specific things, our ritualistic beings, our languages, our governance structures, these to tear down, you know, our essences of being indigenous, in my example, being Anishinaabe. But they couldn't take down those everyday acts, the everydayness of relating with one another that was transmitted. Mm-hmm. Through our language, or our way, our mannerisms, our way of looking at each other, our way of pointing lips, those types of things. Like, those mm-hmm. are things that couldn't be destroyed. And those are the things that carry those stories. So that's kind of what I really want to work on when I'm working, doing this work, this PhD work, is the everyday erotic, the erotic at the level of the body that mm-hmm. couldn't be erased.
Now it's time for our community radio report. For this edition's Community Radio Report, Grimoire received this feature from Gretchen King and CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Quebec and Canada's oldest multilingual community radio station is facing difficult times. For more than 40 years, Radio Centreville has served Montreal's diverse linguistic communities. Today, a looming debt and an accompanying crisis in governance has seen members of the community mobilizing against what they call the tyranny in Radio Centreville. Recent events have resulted in tens of programmers being blocked from accessing the airwaves and the outcomes of members' meetings being ignored by the station's board of directors. Programmers barred from the airwaves held a press conference in February about these issues and to speak out against the commercialization of the community's nonprofit airwaves.
My name is Franz-André Adassé-Trouillot. I'm a member of the radio station of Centreville, Radio Centreville, and specifically of the non-stop Tous les Antilles.
Your program, is it still on air today at Radio Centreville?
No, it's not.
Okay, and how long have you not been on air at Radio Centreville?
It's been about now three, four weeks. Okay. Yes, one night we came in and the door were locked and we were told that we cannot of our program.
Is this what you expected from a community radio station?
Not whatsoever.
Why is that?
Well, this is a radio station that's been around for almost 40 years, if not 40 years. Our program has been in air for 30 years. And this is a democracy here in Montreal. And most of the people, the volunteers, or people that had suffered dictatorship in their countries. So they're coming here knowing that there is a democracy, a freedom of speech, and the Radio Centreville is giving that opportunity, and suddenly not having that freedom of speech because some people have decided we're no longer going to be in their own interest, that's not acceptable.
My name is Mikhail Capelas, member of Radio Centreville since the mid-70s.
And you spoke today at a press conference held by members of Radio Centreville, and specifically about the mandate of community radio. Can you talk about how you see the mandate of community radio related to the current situation at Radio Centreville?
Well, the mandate of the community radios, you can see it in the internet site of the Association des Radios Communautaires du Québec, where you can see that the mandate of those community radios is to reinforce the participation of the citizens in the common affairs. Okay, and when we are starting selling whole hours of programming, then you destroy the nature of the community radio because you do not allow to dozens of citizens, dozens of volunteers to participate in the community radio.
Radio Centreville has indeed been selling airtime for the last few months, and a number of volunteers in community groups have been told that they're no longer on the airwaves of the station. What has been the reaction of groups like your own, working with the Greek group at Radio Centreville? What's been the reaction from the volunteers?
We tried to discuss, to talk with those who implemented those sales of programs, and there is no way to discuss, to have a dialogue with those things. They are decided to sell, and they don't have any other alternative. We propose to continue to try to find other sources of money, and they didn't do anything on that direction.
Whenever the board of the station takes decision like to sell airwaves, it was mentioned here today that the General Assembly is supposed to approve that.
That approval didn't happen, but in the General Assembly of December the 4th, there was one only decision to reject completely the sales of programming. And the board of directors refused to respect the decision of the General Assembly.
Mihail, a Greek language broadcaster at Radio Centreville, said 32 Greek community organizations have signed a letter to denounce the programming changes imposed by the board. For programmers like Mihail, listeners need non-commercial, independent community radio more than ever.
So if you lose the community radios, then you will have the alternate facts, fake news, and Radio Poubelle. So that's the question. Do we want as a society to have more participation of the citizens or not? And a community radio can participate to enforce that engagement of the citizens.
Groundwire will continue to follow this story, reporting for CKUT Radio in Montreal, broadcasting on Anishinaabe lands and unceded Mohawk territory. This is Gretchen King.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at CFRC on Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe traditional trading territory in Kingston, Ontario. Music this week was by Megan Hamilton. We thank all our contributors, as well as Tash Carroll, Janabe Dale, Courtney Harrop, Hugh Ambrose, Shannon Cody, and Sarah Nersessian. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwirenews.ca.